glad you got it.
Very nice. Very nice. At first, I was just vibing because,
right,
I mean,
it's Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye is just
he's
amazing.
He's fantastic.
One of my all-timers, but
there's a purpose.
There you go. That's outstanding. Victoria on the ones and twos. I'm Adam Gold. This is the Adam Gold Show. And if you stay, actually, one of the questions, I'll actually just mention it now, because somebody asked me on Twitter last night, do we have to stay up for the Kane's Corner podcast, or can we go to bed?
Right.
And I just responded, well, I don't really have the option. So, yeah. I mean, I'm not making anybody do it, but I'll be there. Right. So
it'll be there whether you want it, like, live or sleep and then get in the morning.
The majority of the people listen to it, like, when normal people would listen to it. But it's there if you want to. We're talking to, like, most of Australia now anyway. We were on the air at, like, 3:45 p.m. in the afternoon in Adelaide.
Oh, wow. And I wonder what that feels like.
Big time. Big time. Anyway, Hurricanes defensively are a little bit of a mess. And to help me maybe sort through it, my friend Luke DeCock of the News and Observer, who joins us on Fridays. I mean, the numbers are the numbers, and the numbers are gross. And Rod Brindamore is kind of baffled by all of it. And they have to get this sorted out, and it's not going to get any easier tomorrow in Colorado. Do you have a theory other than it's just five games, which is fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just five games, but I think there's some kind of specific things we've seen. One, Antti Raanta hasn't played very well, especially at the start of a couple games. In a five-game sample, that's a big deal.
Right.
Obviously, the 7-7-7 pairing is just not working. And I think, you know, we're going to see in the long term, you and I had this conversation on the first day of training camp.
Yep.
I think Jalen Chatfield's a better fit for Dmitri Orlov than Tony D'Angelo. I think Jalen Chatfield earned the right to play ahead of Tony D'Angelo last year. And if you're going to talk about culture all the time, that's something you need to respect.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is, we saw it last year with Brent Burns. We saw it with Dougie Hamilton. It's really hard to come into the system when you're not used to playing. And so I think we're seeing that right now for Dmitri Orlov. You know, I think the mistakes he's made that are less understandable are his inability to get his shot through, and not just on the shorthanded goals where it's become such a big deal, but just even at even strength, there are a lot of times where he has what looks like an open lane and the puck just comes right back at him. So I don't know whether that's something that Tim Gleason can work on him with. Obviously, it's not something you've seen over the course of his career. It may just be five games of bad luck, but I don't know that I've ever seen a defenseman have more shots ricochet straight back at him and past him than what's happened to Dmitri Orlov. So to answer your original question, yeah, I think a little bit of it is five games. A little bit of it is the impact of goaltending is a little bigger in those five games. You know, I think Antti Raanta is going to be fine. He's off to a bit of a rough.
Yeah, and the truth is, Pyotr Kochetkov, I think Kochetkov came in and played well. Hopefully Freddie Anderson will be ready to go tomorrow in Colorado, but if he's not, I'm all about watching 52 take a swing, so to speak, at the Avalanche. And, I mean, if you're not playing well, especially defensively, that's probably the wrong team to deal with at this point with their speed. Not only up front, but their speed on the blue line, which is absolutely game-changing. Just to specific to the three-man weave on the third defensive pairing, the D'Angelo Orlov. I actually don't think the problem is D'Angelo. Right? Like, people think that we're blaming Tony. I'm not. If we were starting the two players of the three who was playing the best, we'd probably be starting Chatfield and D'Angelo. Tony couldn't bail Orlov out, in my opinion. What we have seen over the first five games of the season is that when problems have arisen, it's Tony really couldn't bail Orlov out, where I think Chatfield can. And plus minus is a skewed stat anyway, but minus 10 matters, I think, on this team. And because it's not just the empty net goals, and I think Orlov's been on the ice for three of the empty net goals, because at the end, he's an offensive player, so you want him out there. But the two shorthanded goals, to me, it's the first one is more about the decision than anything else. He had no cover behind him, and he wasn't at the blue line. He was down almost at the top of the rings when he took the shot that got blocked. That shot has to get through, and it doesn't even have to be on net, but it has to get through. Because there was nobody behind him and he's not fast enough to get back. He was back, but he didn't do much about it, just like he didn't do much about the two-on-one. Maybe that's where Tim Gleason needs to work with him. It's like, here's how we defend a two-on-one. We either block the shot or we deny the pass. And he didn't do either. Let's talk about one positive anyway. Seth Jarvis looks okay.
Yeah, looks like I think what you would expect him to look like. Coming off of last year, you know, he obviously became a better 200-foot player last year and wanted to get back to being a more offensive player this year without giving any of that up, and we've seen that from him. I mean, this is a good sort of development curve for him over the course of his career. It's kind of what, you know, people wanted to see from Marty Natchez. It was a little later in coming, but you're seeing it now, and I think he's bounced back from a little bit of a rough start to be more of the player he was last year. So, with Svechnikov out, you need guys like Jarvis and Natchez to be at their best, because that is still a big hole to fill. We've gotten used to it because it was all of the playoffs and all of April and all of that. But you know, Andrei Svechnikov is the rare sort of player who makes space for himself and others, and they've been doing it so far without that. That said, I don't look at the Hurricanes start and say, oh, the problem is they don't have Andrei Svechnikov. Problem is they're giving up too many goals.
Right.
And that, you know, forwards obviously play a role in that. But I think, you know, you and I so far here today have pretty much documented what the reasons for that are. And here's the thing, you know, just to circle back to your point on Kochetkov, I think the mistake a lot of people made, especially sort of in arguing with me on Twitter, is to think of Antti Raanta as the second goalie and Kochetkov as the third. I've been telling people all along, the way to think of this is, even though Kochetkov is not here and he's in Syracuse or wherever he ends up next, Frederik Andersen is the number one. Peter Kochetkov is the number two, and Antti Raanta is the number three, which he's a role that he's sort of uniquely mentally suited for to be here and not play very often, although obviously the start's not so great, but his history indicates he'll be fine. You know, the fact that we couldn't make it through the first month of the season without Frederik Andersen going out is a little concerning, but that's why, you know, people who are concerned about the three-goalie arrangement, you know, the history of Andersen and Raanta is that they are going to have injuries, although getting popped between the eyes is not necessarily something you can attribute to durability. But you know, that to me is like the Kochetkov situation to me is sort of fine, and this is sort of how it was, one way that it was going to play out.
Let me ask you one more question about this, and then we'll turn our focus to football real quick with Luke Dukak of the News and Observer. So Andre and Sebastian Aho are going to be back, and probably pretty soon. My guess is if we don't see Sebastian, I don't think we'll see Sebastian tomorrow, but if we don't see him in Tampa on Tuesday, I would anticipate they'd both be in the lineup against the Kraken a week from yesterday at PNC Arena when they have their second home opener. What happened? Where do players go? We know Brendan Lemieux is going to come out of the lineup. Where do players go? Who's playing with Jack Drury and Stefan Nason on that last line? I mean, Teuvo Teravainen, to me, is a top six guy. He's got to play with elite players. Otherwise, he's kind of wasting the ability. I mean, how do you set this up?
I think you think of it not as a fourth line.
Right.
And, it's whether they go 11-7 or back to 12-6.
I think 11-7 is bad.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, but that's not what Rod Brind'Amour thinks. And obviously you and I have different feelings about Tony D'Angelo, and that's not what Rod Brind'Amour thinks, which someone said, you need to have faith in the coach. And I was like, look, Rod Brind'Amour is a great coach and has done amazing things for this franchise, but that does not, he's not the Pope. He's not infallible.
With Sotyktu for moderate to severe plaque psoriasis, you could show off your skin again. And you know what that means?
Beach day.
As a TYK2 inhibitor, Sotyktu is the only once-daily pill of its kind for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. Ask your dermatologist about Sotyktu today and learn more at SoClearlyYou.com. That's SoClearlyYou.com. Sotyktu, deucravacitinib, is a prescription treatment for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis who may benefit from systemic therapy or phototherapy. Don't take if you're allergic to Sotyktu. Serious reactions can occur. Before treatment, get checked for infections, including tuberculosis. Sotyktu can lower your ability to fight infections. Don't start if you have one. Serious infections, cancers including lymphoma, muscle problems, and changes in certain labs have occurred. Tell your doctor if you have a history of these events, or if you have an infection or symptoms like fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you have history of hepatitis B or C, liver or kidney problems, high triglycerides, or had a vaccine or plan to. So TYK2 inhibits TYK2, which is part of the JAK family. People 50 and older with heart disease risk factors who use a JAK inhibitor are at increased risk for certain side effects, sometimes fatal. It's unknown if Sotyk2 has the same risks as JAK inhibitors. Call 1-888-SOTYKTU to learn more.
I'm just kidding.
Why?
I'm caping up for Rod. That's all.
Oh, no, look, there's very little you can criticize about Rod Brindamore, but that does not mean he's exempt from any criticism at all. I think, you know, the 11-7 thing and this sort of...
I don't think he likes it, by the way.
Whatever you want to call it, drive to get Tony DeAngelo on the ice, I think is hurting the Hurricanes. And I think, you know, and I think it sends a bad message when Jalen Chatfield isn't playing. But we beat that.
No, that's fine. All right. Next, North Carolina. 3-game run-up to the real stuff. I understand that they could, based on their history and the fact that Georgia Tech has been a thorn, that could be a problem next week. But this is a 3-game run-up to the 3-game finish in which North Carolina should be featured prominently in the college football playoff. Are we all prepared for that?
No, I am. I've been talking about it since the start of the year. I think the thing that surprises me is how little Heisman talk is around Drake May, who I think is maybe not put up video game numbers, but has put the Tar Heels in position to win a lot and played to the best of his ability, especially with some questions at wide receiver. No, and North, look, yes, Georgia Tech is tricky. That's a game that Tar Heels have lost before. I mean, obviously, if they have the lead in the final minute, kneel. Won't make the same mistake others have made against Georgia Tech. But there's no reason why UNC shouldn't be 9-0, very much in the national conversation, heading into what are really 3 very winnable final games that just have a lot of emotional weight to them. Obviously, you know, Duke may at that point still be playing for a spot in Charlotte.
Yeah.
At Clemson, this may not be a vintage Clemson team. That's still a very difficult place to play. And NC State, that's going to be NC State's season. So there's a lot going on there, obviously. But yes, I think North Carolina should be 9-0. I think North Carolina should be very much in the CFP conversation. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the CFP committee with Boo Corrigan, an ACC guy at the lead, handles the differences between UNC and Florida State. Because I think those differences are real and they need to be parsed and assessed. But I'm not sure the committee's up to doing it.
I was talking to Chip Patterson. He doesn't think that Michigan or Georgia right now would be in the top 4 of the college football playoff rankings. And based on what they have accomplished, who have they beat so far this season. I think North Carolina's non-conference schedule has been challenging without being really difficult, right? Minnesota's okay. App State has turned out to be good but not great. South Carolina is okay, and they still have Campbell left. Duke at Florida State. If Riley Leonard is 100%, how do you see that?
I think it's kind of a moot point because I don't think he's going to be 100% regardless.
Okay.
I think if he plays, the question is going to be, I think he'll be able to throw the ball based on what he was able to do this week in practice. I think he'll be able to run a little bit. The question is, will he have that slippery elusiveness that makes him Riley Leonard, the ability to shed tackles, to turn sacks into plus plays? He's been the Mr. Clean magic eraser for the Duke offense, basically turning what should be huge momentum plays for the defense into huge momentum plays for the offense, just because the defense can't tackle him. So the question is, an 85 or 90% Riley Leonard, can he do all those other things? I think so, probably, because he's a good athlete and he'll make it work. Can he be that elusive player that changes, you know, negatives into positives for Duke against a team and a defense that has a lot of athletes where he's going to need his full capability of doing that to give Duke the best chance to win? I think that's the real question for me. I assume at this point that Riley Leonard will play. I assume he'll be something less than full strength, but something more than half strength. And I think it's a question of what he can and can't do that we're only going to find out on the field. I will say this, even with a 90% Riley Leonard, based on the way Duke played against Clemson and Notre Dame, and both games were at home, I think Duke has every chance to win this game. I think there's a decent shot that Florida State, all amped up, at home, big crowd, is overlooking Duke in this game and does the same thing that Notre Dame did a few years ago when Daniel Jones went into South Bend and won and not realize they're in a game until it's too late.
Yeah, Duke's real. Duke's defense is absolutely real. If Riley Leonard can't do the things that Riley Leonard does, if he can't be elusive, then he should not play in this game because he's only going to hurt himself more, and it's going to damage the rest of Duke's season. I'm not saying Duke should, like, you know, sacrifice this game, but if Riley Leonard's not 100%, you know, then he shouldn't play in it. And let Henry Beilin the fourth chuck the ball because he is a great thrower. But I don't think Duke's going to beat them unless they have Riley Leonard and the ability to run and make and just change the game that way. But we'll see. To me, that's what it hinges on. And I think Duke's defense is good enough to slow Florida State down. Final thing for you, but 32nd. It's ours. It's the first one, Luke. The Merseyside Derby. It's at Anfield. Liverpool has given up the first goal in 5 of their first 8 matches. What do you think?
I mean, I remember where I was the last time Everton won at Anfield, and it was not the state of North Carolina. It's been like so long.
13 years ago, right?
There was a big debate among Everton fans, right. The Everton community, whether the Anfield half of the derby has lost some of its...
Yeah,
people aren't as emotional about it as mm-hmm. they used to be because they've been beaten down by not having won there in so long, and that we should just put all our chips on the Goodison Derby and just deal with that. I think this Everton team is capable of beating Liverpool.
I agree with you.
I like what I've seen over the last few weeks. I think there's some cohesiveness there, some coherence there that wasn't there before. They've scored a few goals, which is a novel concept for Everton. So I think there's a chance. I think there's a chance they catch Liverpool, like Florida State and Duke, looking past them a little bit. Sounds impossible to say in a Merseyside derby, but it's certainly possible given the history of this fixture. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but it's always the hope that kills you, and I don't have a ton of hope.
I think it's going to be a heck of a match. I really do. I think Everton will score first, and we'll see if Liverpool can climb over it and get to the line. All right, Luke, good luck. It's early. Get up early tomorrow.
I will say this based on your prediction. If Everton scores a goal, first, last, whenever, I will actually take that and run with it. If it's 1-0, 1-1, 2-1, whatever. I will take a goal at this point in the life cycle of this Everton team.
I love it. You're a real football fan, Luke. Good luck tomorrow.
Thank you.
Luke DeCock. It's like... That's why I look at Everton. If you're an Everton fan, man, you're in. Because they have been hard to root for.